Hello, and welcome to the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast. I'm Abby Branker. I'm here with Alan Kudan.
Hello.
And today we are talking about Psycho. The movie, the book, the remake, the sequel.
I'll admit, before we start all this, I didn't realize that there was anything beyond just the one Alfred Hitchcock movie.
I am absolutely in the same boat as you. I had no idea. I just didn't even know that it was based on a book, that there were sequels and remakes even starring Anthony Perkins. So
Anthony Perkins?
The actor who plays Norman Bates.
I thought that was Vince Vaughn.
In the remake it is. Alan and I watched quite a few Psycho movies today, so it's all fresh in our minds. We're ready to go.
It was a lot of fun.
It was, actually. I think we were surprised by a lot of movies.
Well, this is the second time we've had to watch Psycho for this podcast.
That's true.
As Norman Bates was a strong contender during the Scary Scuffle 2020.
I really love Norman Bates. I know it's very messed up to say, but he's just so dreamy, you know? He really is so charming.
Well, when he's played by Anthony Perkins.
Yes.
Not so much when he's played by Vince Vaughn.
Which is mind-blowing that they cast Vince Vaughn to play Norman Bates.
Well, I mean, he just keeps getting typecast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as, like, the small business owner.
Yeah.
You know, he runs the Bates Motel.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to run Average Joe's Gym in Dodgeball.
Yeah. I don't know. It just, we'll get to it. We'll talk through some of these movies. But first, we're going to get into the history of Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho from 1960 is very important to the horror genre that we know and love today. We've spoken about how revolutionary A Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween were for the slasher genre, but even they owe some of their success to Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Psycho's use of sex, nudity, and violence was unprecedented at the time.
And they use it quite well.
Quite, yeah, I agree. It is no secret that Hitchcock had a fascination with psychology, and most people call Psycho the world's first psychoanalytic thriller.
Really?
Indeed. We can and probably will do an episode at some point on Alfred Hitchcock just as a filmmaker and a person, because obviously his influence on the horror genre is vast. But Psycho is, there's so much to say here just about this one film alone.
Hey, remember when he made The Birds?
Uh-huh. And we found out today that there's a sequel to The Birds.
Yeah, The Birds 2, Land's End.
And that there's a third or a remake in option?
That there's, oh, yeah. So there was a Birds remake made in 1987, apparently. So we got to track that down.
Yeah.
And furthermore, the script is currently being optioned. So it's slated to be remade. And guess who the director's going to be?
Michael Bay.
Well,
I knew because you told me earlier.
You tell me things all the time. And then I play dumb so that you can just say your fun fact. But no, when it's my turn, whatever, move on.
Alfred Hitchcock is an icon and keystone of the history of horror. He was born on August 13th, 1899, and I just love the fact that he was born in the 1800s.
He was born in 1899.
So when Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho came out in 1960, he was 61. Fast math.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so weird to think you're born in the 1800s and mm-hmm. not crazy old.
Yeah.
I mean, now he'd be really old, well, but yeah. he's dead.
He's dead, yeah, sadly. So today's sources.
I mean, he'd be 122.
Yeah, it's pretty old.
Quick math.
I mean, it's not unheard of.
Yeah, it is.
No, people have lived to be longer than older than that.
Name one.
Hey, Google, how old is the oldest person? So we just Googled. The oldest person currently is 117 years old, a Japanese woman.
Well, mankind is supposed to have a hard cap. Mm-hmm. On their age limit at 120.
Really?
I mean, that's out of the Bible.
Oh, really? The Bible? They thought people could live that old back then?
Well,
people were dying so young.
It's because that was the lifespan given to Moses so that he could guide the Israelites, well, to the promised land. And so he needed an extended lifespan to get through the desert.
Who knew?
God.
Well, maybe one day I should sit down and catch up on the Bible. Okay, today's sources, Understanding Psycho, The Uncanny, by Is This Just Fantasy? On YouTube, a bunch of Wikipedia articles, and a bunch of Murderpedia articles.
Don't forget to cite the movies.
Yeah, and we watched Psycho.
And Psycho.
We watched Psycho from 1960, the remake from 1998, Psycho 2 from 87, I believe, 83 or 87, and 83. And yeah, I think those are the movies that we watched.
Yeah. We did not watch Psycho 3.
No, but it does have...
But we're going to.
Yeah, it has...
Actually, how many are there?
4, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah. They say, usually people say 2 and 3 are pretty good for... jumps the shark, if you can imagine.
Well, I don't want to start talking about the movies.
Yeah, we'll cover off on
because
this.
You're gonna yell at me.
Psycho was released in 1960, a year after North by Northwest. Surprisingly, North by Northwest was shot in color with a much bigger budget, and many people were initially confused by Psycho's aesthetic choices because, of course, it's black and white. And it was produced and directed by Alfred Hitchcock. The screenplay was written by Joseph Stefano, based on the book same name, which came out in 1959, written by Robert Bloch. The movie was independently financed by Hitchcock, with a budget just over $800,000.
Still pretty good.
So it was released with a studio, but he funded it and produced it totally on his own as an independent person.
Hmm. I mean, yeah, they still had to build sets for everything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's pretty expensive.
Very expensive.
But the set is quite enduring, actually.
Yeah, they really spared no expense.
They began filming on November 11th, 1959, and concluded on February 1st, 1960. Alan, you'll appreciate this part.
Why?
Filming started every morning and ended each evening, 6 p.m. at the latest, so that Hitchcock and his wife could eat at Chasen's, which was a famous Hollywood restaurant that the Hollywood elite would go to.
Chasen's.
But you really love a scheduled
hard outs.
Hard outs, yeah, on a schedule.
Oh, that's the best.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, everyone has places to be.
Right.
Or just not at work.
Right. Work can't be your life, everybody.
That's right. Especially if your work is psycho.
I mean, I really enjoy Hitchcock. Like, he often, one of my favorite sayings. One thing I feel like I quote quite often, he has a quote where he says, you know, the length of a film should... directly correlate to, you know, the size of someone's bladder. I just feel like he has a very practical approach to filmmaking where, like, he's going to go have dinner every night, giving people good work-life balance, and he makes movies that aren't too long and full of themselves, you know? Like, he's like an auteur, but he's not like a Kubrick.
Don't get me started on the birds.
Okay.
I didn't like it.
I know. It's okay. You'll also appreciate this, Alan. Most of the film was shot using 50mm lenses on 35mm cameras.
Yeah.
Hitchcock felt that this helped to mimic human vision and bring the audience into the story even more. Before filming...
Classic Hitchcock move right there.
Before filming, Hitchcock sent his assistant to Phoenix to scout locations that were later recreated in the Hollywood studio.
Cool.
So the lot, obviously, the hotel, the Bates Motel, the Psycho House, as it's come to be coined... were recreated based on like scout photos because it takes place in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And then recreated on this Hollywood lot. And of course, the Psycho House still endures in some extent to this day. All right, before we get into the meat of this episode.
We're not in the meat.
We're into it, but I forgot to say it earlier.
Thought we'd been chewing the fat.
Okay, well, before we get further into this episode, I'm not going to apologize if you have not seen Psycho.
So, fair warning. There's going to be some spoilers about Psycho as we talk about Psycho.
There's going to be a lot of spoilers. So if you haven't seen Psycho, that's a prerequisite for this episode.
Okay, so pause the tape.
Pause the tape. Go back. Watch Psycho.
All of them.
Where did we watch it? Peacock, Hulu? Somewhere. Know. In the film adaptation, we have famous performances by Anthony Perkins playing Norman Bates and Janet Leigh as Marion Crane.
And William H. Macy as the private eye, the gumshoe.
That's in the remake. Though Psycho was in it, just so you know, Alan, everything we're talking about right now is the original. Though Psycho was initially met with mixed reviews, it went on to be nominated for 4 Academy Awards.
What were they?
Including Best Supporting Actress and Best Director. Though they did not win an Academy Award, Janet Leigh won the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress.
Hmm.
During filming, Perkins and Leigh were allowed to improvise and interpret their roles as they'd like, as long as it didn't involve moving the camera, which is like another, like I feel like very like Hitchcock thing to do of,
right?
It's very relatable. It's like, yeah, you can, yeah, sure, but just like don't mess with my shot.
Exactly. It's like, I spent a long time making it look just like this.
Yep.
Don't you fucking dare change your marks.
He's like a director who's more concerned with the camera than the performances.
I mean, clearly he's doing something right.
Clearly. I love him. I mean, I know there's also probably a dark side to him, but...
Yeah, he made the fucking birds.
So an example of this improv, right? Anthony Perkins had Norman Bates eat candy corn throughout the movie.
Oh, that was the actor's choice.
That was his choice, yeah.
What was the significance of candy corn?
Tastes good. And it's like a childhood thing probably, right?
Mm. Maybe he just like brought candy corn to set one day. And they're like, we have to roll. And he's like, fuck you. And just keeps eating his candy corn.
Yeah.
And then the script supervisor is like, well, continuity.
Also during production, Hitchcock created many different iterations of the mother dead skeleton body and would hide it in Janet Leigh's dressing room. So this is one thing he did that's kind of fucked up.
I mean, that's pretty funny.
Reportedly, she took it very well. And most believed it was done to keep her on edge during filming.
I mean, yeah, you don't want her too comfortable.
No.
She's got to get through the first 20-something minutes of the movie.
45.
What?
Hitchcock was not involved in any of the sequels or spinoffs that come to follow, so including a remake, three sequels, a TV series, and a made-for-TV spinoff.
So we saw the original.
Yes.
Psycho 2.
Correct.
And Psycho Remake 1987.
1998.
Yes. So... Oh, wait, that's why I was thinking 87, because that was the TV movie.
Gotcha. And those...
Which was called Bates Motel.
Yes.
Which is not to be confused with the series of the same name, which came out in 2013.
That is right, yes.
And there's also Psycho 3 and 4, which have some bylines.
Right, yep. We also have to call out that the original film was released in 1960, just as the production code... A set of film content guidelines was on the decline. It was extremely bold for the time in its use of sexuality and violence. In many ways, it was the first film of its kind to show what it did. Marion in a bra, the shower scene, graphic violence, blood, even showing an unmarried couple in the same bed was shocking for the time.
So while we were watching Psycho original,
yes,
I chimed in my fun little film tidbit that Psycho was the first movie to show a toilet on screen. This, however, turned out to not be true.
Uh-huh.
It was predated twice. Most notably in 1957, Leave It to Beaver.
Oh, that groundbreaking show, Leave It to Beaver.
But it was really predated by a silent film called The Crowd from 1928.
I mean, even still, the fact that there's only two things before Psycho in 1960 that show a toilet, it's like a little bit...
Oh, what the hell? I'm Googling now, and there's like, well, no, Psycho was the first to show it flushing.
Yeah.
But then there's, you know, some guy that just jumps in and says, no, there's that movie from 1930 called Going Wild that showed a flushing toilet.
I mean, still, the fact that there's like a handful of examples before Psycho of toilets in movies is insane. It wasn't a plot point at all before.
No. Why would it be?
It's crazy to me.
It's not a plot point now.
Okay. So it is a plot point in... it is a plot point, actually.
It is?
Yeah. But speaking of plot, let's do a quick overview of the plot.
Okay. So here we go.
You're going to do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Marion, is her name?
Yeah, yep. Off to a good start.
Marion steals $4,000.
$40,000.
$40,000 from her work.
What's her job?
She works at an office. I don't know.
It's a real estate company.
Yeah, exactly. And then she skips town, not with her boyfriend. She just takes the $40,000 and runs. And no one knows why. And then Norman finds her.
Norman finds her?
Well, no, the rain finds her.
Uh-huh.
And she gets it's too rainy. So,
God.
So she pulls over to park for the night.
No, she pulls over to park for the night because she can't keep her eyes open.
No, that was
then
earlier.
Then the next night.
That, yeah.
the rain overtakes her and she ends up at the Bates Motel.
Right. And she's at, who's telling us? You or me?
I don't know.
And then she's there. She's at the Bates Motel and she's hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And so Norman offers to make her sandwiches and milk.
My absolute favorite old time movie meal. I am obsessed. Always in old movies, they eat sandwiches and milk, especially late at night. And I just love it so much.
So then he murders her. And
no, we don't see him murder her. We see a shadow of an old woman.
She gets murdered. And then
in the shower.
Yeah, in the shower. And then Norman cleans up the mess. And he's like, "Mom, you did it." And everyone thinks the mom did it, right?
Yeah.
And then he dumps her in the swamp.
In the car. Where we have the moment, right? Where the car pauses.
Right, because it doesn't sink, but then it does sink.
Yeah, and it's one of those like classic film moments.
Yeah, yeah. And then he comes back, and then people show up asking about her. And
who shows up?
One of the gumshoe. The gumshoe shows up.
No, okay.
And he like presses Norman for details, and Norman slips up his alacrity a little bit, and then he's forced to kill the gumshoe, and then Marion's boyfriend and her sister show up,
mm-hmm.
and then Norman, dressed up as the mom, tries to kill them. And then we realize that the mom's been dead the whole time, and Norman's kind of nuts.
Yeah. Okay, that's somewhat accurate. Yeah.
I just read that verbatim from the little caption on the TV guide.
No, you didn't. Okay, so first let's talk about the shower scene.
I already talked about the shower scene.
I'm talking about, let's analyze the shower scene.
Okay.
I'm not being dramatic when I say that Psycho's shower scene is one of the most infamous scenes in all of cinema.
I was actually asking you about this earlier, but you still haven't given me an answer. Can you think of a more iconic scene than the Psycho shower scene?
Well, I said to you then, and I will say it again now, it's hard for me because my household was so Hitchcock heavy growing up that, no, like, I don't know, I can't, but I'm sure there is, like, maybe like a scene from The Wizard of Oz or something like that.
I was just thinking The Wizard of Oz when they start skipping down the Folly Hill.
Yeah. I think there's probably certainly if you weren't somebody whose family was big into Hitchcock or classic films, you've probably seen like The Wizard of Oz still, but you might not have seen Psycho.
Oh, or the part in Terminator 2 when he's like, you know, he sacrificed himself so that John Connor can live.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like going in, and then the hand gives the thumbs up right before it goes into the molten steel.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
That's a really good one.
But so I think it depends, because I've also never seen Terminator 2, right?
What the? No, really?
Yeah.
You're messing with me.
Or maybe you made me watch a Terminator. Was it that one?
I'm stunned. Okay. It's my favorite movie.
Yeah.
All we do is watch your favorite movies, like Psycho and The Birds.
Oh, you don't even know, Alan, how many of your movies we watch. Okay, so Alan and I, both film school graduates, can vouch for the fact that the shower scene from Psycho is still taught in film classes. Like, we both...
Confirmed.
We both had focuses on it in film school. And I don't know. It's iconic in that way. So yes, I would say sure. There's other films that are probably more universally known, but I think regardless, within the cinema world, it's a very important scene.
I mean, I think the only reason why, say, something like The Wizard of Oz jumps at me a bit more is just because it lifts the age restriction.
Yeah, totally. So the shower scene was filmed between December 17th and 23rd, 1959. It had been postponed by Janet Leigh twice, once because she didn't feel well, she had a cold, and once because she had her period. Famously, 77 different camera angles were used in the final edit, and the scene lasts for 3 minutes, with 50 cuts. Here's a quote from Hitchcock. "As you know, you could not take the camera and just show a nude woman. It had to be done impressionistically. So it was done with little pieces of film, the head, the feet, the hand, etc. In this scene, there were 78 pieces of film in about 45 seconds. So the style, right, feels very poetic and unrealistic in a way. Something we'll talk a little bit more in a minute, but Hitchcock described this as transferring the menace from the screen into the mind of the audience.
Oh.
So
that's what that does?
That's what he thought it did.
Oh.
You'll see as we talk more about it too, he has a lot of tricks like this, like ways of editing or framing shots that he thinks have some kind of like psychological effect.
He's a tricky guy.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
I think so too.
Remember in Rear Window, the twist was that there was no twist?
I mean, he's...
Tricky guy.
He's a big he has all this interest in psychology, which you can see in things like Vertigo and Rear Window as well. The blood in the scene was played by Hershey's chocolate syrup.
Only in the North American release. Everywhere else it was Nutella.
Stop it. Oh my God. They chose this because it has a good density, especially for the black and white film stock. It shows up well. There are vastly different reports when it comes to whether Lee, Janet Lee, had a body double or not during parts of the scene. Different books on the film state different things. Lee herself claims that she was in the scene in its entirety, and a double was only used when Bates transfers the body to the trunk of the car. One incorrect theory...
Oh, she's too good to be in the fucking shower curtain trunk?
That's right. Too good. Too famous. One incorrect theory that emerged was that the crew used cold water in an effort to elicit icy screams from Lee. But she denied this, saying the crew was very accommodating. So, I don't know. What's your take on the shower scene?
So, this was just the quintessential scene when film school is like, and now you all have to learn how to edit. Just take a look at this. Because it's all about implying things. For instance, she's naked in the shower getting murdered by getting stabbed 1,000 times. Yet you never once see a stab. And you never see nudity. Like you never see like nipples or anything like that.
Yep.
It's always just like pieces of skin, her from behind, something like that. You never see that. You see like the knife swing through the air or like get ready to strike. And it's all about the way that the cuts are put together with the music score and the music cues and that sort of thing. And you're horrified, even though you never actually saw anything that's technically scary.
Yeah. I mean, Psycho is such a delicious mix of horror elements. You know, there's the soundtrack, which is iconic.
Yeah.
Especially the, credit song, which I think is called The Murderer, composed by Bernard Herrmann, and it's the same shower scene song that you hear. It's, like crazy cellos and string instruments.
It's a very uncomfortable sound to hear.
Yeah, and it also has like some similar like noise elements, I don't know the right word, but the stabbing noises that are happening,
And you also never get a good look at the killer's face.
Yep.
Despite the fact that you look right at the killer's face. So props to how it was lit.
Yeah.
Maybe you have more about this, but was it just special lighting? Was it special makeup and everything that obscured the face?
Everything. So yeah, it's shadow. It's purposeful shadow. And we're going to talk about it. But Hitchcock uses shadows and mirrors very, very specifically in this movie to build the tension. Right. And I think Psycho is so impactful, because the script is so good. There's so many intriguing elements. It's creepy and off and strange, and we're going to talk about the psychology behind it and the aesthetic choices of it, but it really is this marriage of very conscious filmmaking, and I feel like he, and I think this is kind of echoed in the fact that his previous film was in color, but I think it was a lot more impactful because it was black and white.
Absolutely.
And he had the ability to play with shadow and reflections and things so much more with black and white than he would have if it was a color film.
Well, it's like when you're trying to learn photography.
Yeah.
You're supposed to start with black and white simply because color does a lot of the heavy lifting for you. There's just a lot more going on with color. There's so many more variables. And with black and white, it's so much more about the composition.
Yes.
And the juxtaposition of just your simple gradient, I think you have to be a better photographer to pull off black and white than you have to do for color. But I mean, we saw this when we get to the 1998 remake, which is nearly a shot-for-shot remake of the film.
Oh, it's more than that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, how can it be more?
It's because, first of all, they use the same exact script, same exact locations, and...
Well, mostly.
the blocking of the actors, the way the facial expressions, they literally, and we talked about this, they literally studied what the original actors did and then did the same thing.
And it comes off as very disgenuine.
Right. Like, you don't, with Vince Vaughn, and we'll talk about this more, but like with Vince Vaughn, you're not like, oh, it's creepy. You're like, oh, he watched Anthony Perkins play Norman Bates and he's doing that. Like Anthony Perkins, you watch him and you're like, oh, he's Norman Bates. Mm-hmm. You watch Vince Vaughn, you're like, oh, he's Anthony Perkins. Mm-hmm. Or he's trying to be. Yeah.
But that movie was in color.
Yes.
And it was not nearly as creepy.
No, not at all.
Or as just like, I didn't care about anything.
Right. Yeah. The tone and feel of the film switches very quickly after Marion is killed. Most film theorists...
Sorry, spoiler alert these things.
We spoiler alerted the whole episode. We also just talked for 10 minutes about the shower scene where she's killed.
We said she gets murdered.
The tone and feel of the film switches very quickly after Marion is murdered. Most film theorists agree that this is a classic case of a red herring. Hitchcock sets up Marion as the main character and focus of the film, making her abrupt murder even more disturbing. So the fact that she survives for 45 minutes of the film, which is about a third of the film, is very bizarre for this kind of movie.
It's weird.
You know, you would never spend 45 minutes on character development to set up a murder victim. It's very out of the norm. And so there's some different theories here.
You might, but you wouldn't set up to be a murder victim and then have the whole movie switch protagonists.
Right.
That was just wild.
And yeah, so there's a few theories. One is A, of course, it's this red herring and we build up this connection with her. And when she's taken from us, it's disturbing, right?
So we're in an era of filmmaking when these things aren't cliche yet. One really fun bit about just like watching older films that kind of like wrote the book on things is that you are watching these tropes that are now 100% cliche. But back when these films came out, they were brand spanking new. They caught the audience off guard. And in this case, they still even broke the normal cliche by taking away someone that was absolutely covered in plot armor. You know, normally your protagonist, if you have spent so much intimate time getting to know them, you know, getting inside like their little private moments in their head of like, you know, their wants and dreams of their motive, character motivations, right? And then they get into a dangerous situation, they get out of it because they're the fucking protagonist. That's plot armor. But nope, Norman Bates shows up, stabby stab, she's done.
She's done. So yeah, absolutely. It's bizarre. Even nowadays, honestly, it's bizarre. And it's a very long time to set this up. There are so many slasher movies, right, where they keep certain victims alive for a long period of time, you know? And like, you know, people are killed kind of like throughout, right? Which is similar to what happens in this film, but our relationship as viewers with Marion becomes intimate, like you said. And so we're solely focused on her. It's not like a teen slumber party, right? Where people are one by one getting killed.
It's not the group. It's everybody.
Right. It's you're right. She is the one person that we care about in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Like, just imagine you're watching Alien and then 40 minutes into the film, Ripley dies.
Right.
And then you're just on the spaceship with the alien. As the alien talks to its dead mom.
I'd watch that movie.
Yes, yeah, Psycho in Space. Write that down.
So there's a very heavy influence of Freud in this movie.
Okay.
Norman Bates' sexual fixation on his mother.
Oh, here we
AKA the Oedipus complex.
Well, yeah. So Oedipus complex of wanting to kill your father and sleep with your mother.
Tell us about Oedipus Rex.
The guy?
Yeah.
You want the story of Oedipus Rex?
Aren't you the Greek expert of this show?
Okay, sure. Oedipus was born, and there was a prophecy saying that he was going to kill his father, the king, and marry his mother, the queen. And so as soon as Oedipus was born, they're like, oh, fuck no. So they grabbed him by his ankle, and they threw him down a hill.
They grabbed him by his ankle?
They grabbed him by his ankle and threw him down a hill. Yeah.
I never knew that ankle part before.
Yeah, it's his name. I forget what the Oedip part. It's something foot. His name is something foot.
Interesting.
And Oedipus Rex is Oedipus the king. So he survives and he's on his way back to town and he meets this guy on a horse. And he's like, guy, get out of the way. And the horse is like, fuck you. Not the horse, the guy on the horse. He's like, get out of my way. And Oedipus is like, don't you know who I am? And the guy on the horse is like, I don't know who you are. Do you know who I am? He says, no. He said, okay, let's fuck with each other. and they fight, and Oedipus kills this guy. Because he's kind of being a jerk, right?
The guy on the horse was?
Yeah, guy on the horse is being a jerk. So Oedipus kills him. He didn't want to kill him, but, you know, he's being a jerk. So he gets back to town. He like, grew up knowing that he was a king, or, like, he came from, like, royal blood, but he thought he came from, like, some distant land, right?
Yep.
And so he gets back.
He didn't realize they just threw him down the hill by his ankle.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he gets back, and I forget the exact order of events, but he eventually rises up through the ranks and ends up marrying the widowed queen. Oh, I'm sorry. Back up. So there's a big hunt for the killer of the king. And Oedipus is, like, leading this hunt. He's like, oh, who killed the king? This is crazy. Little does he know, that was the guy on the horse.
Yep.
So
you would think he would maybe ask, you know.
You'd make
the connection.
You'd think so, but it's tough back then. They didn't have internet. So he ends up rising up through the ranks, marrying the queen, which is actually his mother, Jocasta. Is that her?
I don't know.
Might be Jocasta. Then as soon as he finds out that the guy that he killed was the king, his father, that he is the killer himself, and the woman that he's stooping is his mom.
Stooping.
He is just so overcome by grief that he takes some pokers and he gouges out his own eyes.
This is the second episode now you said stooping.
It is?
I thought you just made that up. Is that a real thing?
Yeah. Yeah, of course it's a real thing.
So thank you, Alan, for that.
Oedipus
recap.
It's mildly inaccurate.
Well, that's our slogan here. But all of that to say that there is very strong Oedipus complex issues in this story. So the quick background for those who may have forgotten around Norman's mother. Norman's mother and Norman were very close, right? They lost his dad. So the two of them were very close for a very long time.
Can't wait to find out what happened to Norman's father when we watch 3 and 4, because they keep bringing back old family members.
Yeah. And so him and his mom really close because they lost his dad. And one day his mom takes a new lover and Norman feels like he's been shut out, right? So he murders them. He poisons her tea, murders them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he keeps the body. He goes and gets the body. I think he gives him a weighted coffin and he just keeps her body and preserves it in the fruit cellar.
Because he's good at taxidermy.
That's right. Preserves it and carries her around, you know, hangs out with her and starts to develop in his head a voice that represents her. And so what happens when Marion comes is that Norman is attracted to her.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother, half of his brain, becomes jealous and kills the girl. Oedipus complex 101, really.
Yeah.
Additionally, the Bates home is set up on 3 levels, which some think are meant to represent Freud's 3 levels of subconscious, superego, ego, and id.
Which I have to think is nothing but fucking masturbatory cinema studies majors talking about this movie.
Could be. Though you and I are both film students, I don't love them.
Nope.
The uncanny or unhomely, which is a feeling of unease you get when you experience something familiar, but suddenly it feels unfamiliar. So the idea, right, of seeing like a teacher outside of school is a really good example.
Oh, heaven forbid you see him at the supermarket.
That's God, weird. It's so embarrassing. Within horror, we often see uncanny doubles or doppelgangers. The evil side of someone that we see reflected in a mirror, for example, like Black Swan. If you've seen the movie Sisters by Brian De Palma, one of my all-time favorite movies, great example of this as well. Even more broadly, we talk about the humanoid shape, right? So we have, most famously, our episode on clowns, where we talked about how clowns are so scary because they look so close to a normal human looks like, but there's something about them that's off, right? And it's almost like the more subtle the offness, the creepier it is. Attack on Titan is another great example of the uncanny valley.
Right, because the Titans just, they have like normal, cute human features, sort of, but everything is just twisted a little bit.
And their mouths are like gaping.
Right, but it's perfectly normal human teeth, which makes it, if they had fangs, so much less scary.
Yeah.
But the fact that they have perfectly normal human chompers.
Chompers. Yeah. It's like the it's like too close for comfort, you know?
Yeah.
And most obviously, Mother acts in Psycho as Norman's alter ego and uncanny double. However, Marion and Norman are also doubles. So their names actually contain very similar letters, which is believed to be on purpose because the character in the novel is called Mary, not Marion. So mm-hmm. Hitchcock changed that. And of course, Norman is very close to normal, is it not?
It is very close to normal.
Another interesting cinematography thing is that most of their interactions when Marion and Norman interact, there's a mirror in the background reflecting them back to the audience.
Mm.
So here's a quote from the Parallax View, page 227. Marion's world is the world of contemporary American everyday life, whereas Norman's world is the nocturnal reverse. The relationship between the two worlds is that of two surfaces of a Mobius strip. If we progress far enough to one surface, all of a sudden we find ourselves on its reverse. So these two characters and their story arcs are dependent on each other. There are many film critics and scholars that have looked very closely at the nuances of this film and how psychology plays into the actual cinematography and editing. So does that sort of make sense, right? That Marion represents, like, all she desires is to have, like, this quote-unquote normal life, right? She wants to marry her boyfriend, she wants to be on the up and up, she wants things to work out for them, even though he's kind of trying to keep her as kind of like a hotel gal, you know?
Hotel gal.
Like, he wants to, like, hook up with her, and he's not really being committing, you know? And then on the other side, you have Norman, who is very respectful of her at first, right? He doesn't go into her room when they have dinner, he sets up boundaries, right?
If you want an in-depth look at my hotel gal, please check out our episode on the Bowery Hotel.
And right, so Norman, but he kind of runs this motel, right? He's kind of like the other side of it. And so there's this duality between the two of them, that they're both seeking things, that they're both stuck in some ways, right? Outside of their own, they have this whole conversation in the back of the hotel office about how they're both in these various cages, that she set up this cage for herself because she stole this money, but that she felt trapped before, right? Because her life wasn't progressing. And Norman, on the other hand, is also in this cage, again, by his own doing, right? Because he has this mental illness, he did all this stuff that got him into this situation, but that he's also stuck in this cycle, a mental cycle with his mother.
The one thing, I mean, this is more of just like a talking point, because everything is just done so well. But the one thing that I didn't really, that I just kind of took me, struck me as odd, was that she stole money. She is a criminal.
Yeah.
And she becomes like the murdered innocence in the film, you know?
Well, does she? I feel like she still has, she gets a lot of, what's the right word?
Slack.
She gets a lot of like heartache, I feel like, from the PI. People are, you know, she is set up as they're looking for her. They don't realize she's murdered right away. They're looking for her to find the money.
Right. So maybe it's a plot device in order to justify looking for her.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like it adds a whole other level of her character complexity.
No, that's the point, that neither her nor Norman are entirely good nor bad.
Mm. Oh, there you go.
You know,
yep.
She's murdered, but she stole a ridiculous amount of money from a shitty guy, but still, right? And then on the other side, like, Norman has this mental illness in a lot of ways he's a victim of, and of circumstances and all these things, and he's so charming and cute, but he's also a murderer, right? So,
well, he's charming and cute in the original.
Yeah.
not as Vince Vaughn.
And in the sequel.
Yeah, yes. He's even, well, in Psycho 2, he's 20 years older.
Yeah.
And he's still, for me, that's when boyish Norman Bates comes through even more.
Mm.
I think he's just like a really great actor.
I love
him.
I agree. We should watch more of his movies.
I hope he's in the Michael Bay remake of The Birds.
The Birds, yeah. So again, let's talk a little bit about the cinematography and the editing and how that helps drive home some of the points.
They used both of those things to make this film.
They did. So one example of this is that until Marion is in the car heading for the motel, the film only uses fades between shots to convey the passage of time. However, in this scene, we see that the filmmaker switched to straight cut. So suddenly, you know, boom, the sky is much darker. Boom, the sky is darker again. And we're not getting crossfades between us to say, like, which is a classic film tool to say right. time has passed. It's just being, it's like jump cutting, right?
Yep.
And at the same time, the camera is coming in closer and closer and closer. And so a lot of people think that they're doing this because Marion is not aware of the time passing, that she's stuck in her own head right in this moment. In this scene, we also experience her imagining how her boss will react when he finds the money is gone. She's hearing his voice. She's hearing the guy that she stole the money from. She's hearing all of these voices and hearing them talk shitty about her.
And she's smiling.
Yeah, so we'll That's get weird. To that. We'll
Why?
Get to
Why
that.
Is she smiling?
Hang on, we'll get to that in a
okay,
minute.
Okay, okay.
So she's, right, she's frantic. She's distracted. She's caught up as she drives, right?
Yeah.
The shots, like I said, get closer and closer. The depth of field decreases so that the things around her are more out of focus and we're less aware of her surroundings. The rain becomes heavy. The lighting becomes dramatic. She's very shadowed. So it's a transition from day to night, but it's also a transition from reality to subconscious, from Marion's world to Norman's world. Right at the end of this sequence, Marion smiles and looks directly into the camera, which precisely mirrors Norman's famous shot later in the film, right, where he's in the holding cell and he looks into the lens and smiles. And shot by shot with those, you know, next to each other, which you can Google very easily, is very, very obviously deliberate.
Yeah, I think they did that on purpose.
Yeah, and I think to answer your question, it's exactly what we were just talking about, right? Like, to say every, like, also, hello, when Norman says we all go a little mad sometimes. The point is that neither of them are good nor evil. They're both. They're humans.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this cycles to them, right? Where she goes through this arc and then he goes through a similar arc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that moment, it's sort of like when she smiles to me, it proves out this like little bit of criminal inside of her, for lack of a better word, where she,
sure,
she's like, she's picturing in her head all of the aftermath of her crime.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's smiling about it, right? Which is exactly what Norman does at the end, you know?
It's true.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously not to equate like stealing money and murdering people, but,
well,
you know. So again, later on, when Norman is in the holding cell, right, he also hears his mother's voice in a voiceover, just as Marion heard the stern words of her boss. They're both talking shit about them. The parallels really are endless. The client that Marion takes the money from comes across as fatherly but older, and they also flirt. Then she even talks about how she flirts with him, which many people see as kind of like the a similar relationship with Norman and his mother later on.
Mm-hmm.
Like a fatherly figure that there's some weird sexual...
I gotcha.
Yeah. Another parallel. What does Marion really want? The film starts with a scene between her and her lover, Sam, meeting at a hotel on their lunch break to have sex, which again, this scene was groundbreaking at the time. So she tells Sam that she won't keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
That she wants a respectable relationship where they have dinner at her house with her sister. The portrait of her mother is looking over them, right? That she's like, he wants to meet in hotels. She wants to have, you know, a quote unquote, more above board type of relationship.
Right.
Later on, Norman and Marion have dinner, right? She gets to the motel. He says, you hungry? I'll make you some sandwiches and milk. And he brings a sandwich, the tray of sandwiches to her room. But then he won't come inside. He says, oh, come in the parlor, which many people think is sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but he could have gone, if he was into her, right, he could have gone into this room and tried to make a move. But instead, he puts up this boundary of like, no, come, let's have dinner together in a more respectable place. Like,
right, 'cause my mother doesn't want me going in that room.
Exactly. And so it's kind of like this fucked up response to her desire, right? At the beginning, she paints this picture of, I just want my boyfriend to come to my house for dinner with my sister. I don't want to just keep having sex in this hotel room. And she meets Norman and he's like, no, I don't want to go into this hotel room with you. I want you to come and have dinner with me in my parlor, right? So it's sort of like this weird call and response to initial desire.
He first invites her up to his house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only after the mother, if you will, starts yelling that she's not welcome in the house, that he has to go back between his tail between his legs, being like, hey, sorry, yeah, let's just eat here.
Right, but he still doesn't go into her room.
No, he doesn't.
Which would have been, you know.
But he offers exactly what she wanted.
Yeah.
to have dinner in a house with a family.
That's right. So Hitchcock uses shadow as well in the film. In the opening scene, Venetian blinds fall across Marion in the hotel room. Mother is only seen in shadow until the end when we find out that it's actually Norman, including, like you were talking about, the famous shower scene where he's so doused in shadow, you only see the silhouette. You see the wig, and so you assume it's his mother, right?
Right.
And so there's also the theme of birds.
Birds?
Not the movie The Birds. Norman talks about how much he loves stuffing things, quote unquote.
Oh, yeah, those birds.
And he's surrounded by his taxidermy birds. Marion's last name is also Crane. The motel rooms have tons of photos of birds on the walls. And Norman even tells Marion at one point that he eats like a bird.
Well, one thing to note is that the birds on the wall in her room are just like small little run-of-the-mill birds, right? And then all the birds stuffed in Norman's office are birds of prey.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great call out. Many also believe that Bates's mother acts as the original bird because he preserves her for so long. And also obviously consider, right, and he has his taxidermy birds, but also consider the way that mother birds take care of their nested babies. Very intimate.
Yeah, birds.
Birds. Psycho the book was loosely based on the true events of one of the most famous serial killers in modern history.
William H. Gacy.
Ed Gein.
What? Is William H. Gacy? No, I'm thinking William H. Macy.
Yeah, you're thinking of John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah, because William H. Macy was in the Psycho remake.
That's right. So be warned for this next section. I'm not going to go into this too deeply, but just be warned it's a little bit...
Because that's what other podcasts do.
Exactly.
They deep dive into serial killers, and that's not us.
It's not us.
Drawing that line in the sand right here.
We're not drawing the line in the sand because we don't love those podcasts. We're drawing the line in the sand because they're already doing such a great job, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
So be warned again that Ed Gein's crimes are horrific and incredibly dark. And we're only going to cover them really briefly. But if you want a more in-depth look at this monster, I will direct you to episode 174, 5, and 6 of Last Podcast on the Left.
Oh, it's like, what? I don't remember doing those.
Which is a three-part series on Ed Gein. And again, they are really my true crime experts. They are so well-researched, and I enjoy their personalities very much. So I will direct you to the Last Podcast on the Left if you want to learn more. But again, this is very, very dark stuff.
Okay.
First and foremost, Psycho's writer Robert Bloch only lived about 40 miles from Ed Gein. The similarities between Gein and Bates are undeniable. Most influential, both had overbearing mothers who died. Both had dedicated a secret room in their homes as a shrine to their dead mother, and both also dressed up in the clothes of their deceased mothers. Ed Gein was born on August 27, 1906. His crimes were committed in his hometown.
Which was just 7 years after Alfred Hitchcock.
That's true. His crimes were committed in his hometown, Plainfield, Wisconsin. Though he is believed to be a serial killer, Gein was only actually convicted with the murder of two women, making him technically not a serial killer.
What's the cutoff?
Maybe three?
Oh.
I don't know. Here's where things get a bit rough. Gein was known to exhume bodies from their graves, remove human skin, and make things out of it.
Oh, like the guy from Silence of the Lambs.
In addition to the heads of the two women he was convicted of killing being found on his property and in his home, police also found multiple human noses, 9 human skin masks, bowls made from human skulls. And I am going to stop here because it gets very, very graphic, the things that he hoarded, collected, categorized.
Pokemon cards.
No, all of them coming from dead bodies.
Oh.
Very upsetting stuff. A lot of genitalia being grouped into shoeboxes. It's not a good scene. It should not be surprising to learn that Leatherface is another character often believed to be based on Gein, and Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs, as you just said. Gein's mother was famously controlling and overbearing, allowing her children only to leave the house to go to school to prevent the influence of outsiders on her family. She also taught her sons that all women, except for herself, were sex workers and instruments of the devil. She was a devout Lutheran and held considerable control over her sons. we can start to see the similarities, right, between Bates and Geens.
Also,
Geen. I said Geens. The strange controlling relationship between mother and son, especially when it comes to their interaction with prospective romantic partners. Also, the condemnation of all women. Bates essentially punishes himself on behalf of his mother for being attracted to Crane. After arrest, Geen underwent many psychological tests. He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, and among other things, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which obviously Norman Bates also suffers from.
Mm-hmm.
Though, according to Block, the writer, he had already started writing the character when Geen was discovered. I'm quoting him here. He was struck by how closely the imaginary character I'd created resembled the real Ed Geen, both in overt act and apparent motivation, end quote.
Hmm.
Block wrote a fictionalized story of Geen called The Shambles of Ed Geen, which came out a few years later in 1962. So you can check that out if you're interested in diving even deeper into this. Block has also hinted that Norman Bates is also based on Calvin Beck. And Beck is the publisher of Castle of Frankenstein, which was a comic book, but I can't find more about why him and Norman Bates are connected.
Castle of Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
That's different. That's from Frankenstein.
Psycho is one of the most famous films of all time, across any genre. Though speaking specifically about horror, as we do here, Psycho set a new precedent. It's loaded with themes and motifs, packing subtleties and complexities into each frame. Hitchcock pays great attention, not only to the depth of his stories, but how he can best use cinematography to bring the audience into his film. Slasher movies all pay homage, in their own way, to the shower scene in Psycho, and all psychological thrillers seem to stem from this original version in some way. Any filmmaker who dabbles in the dark side of humanity owes something to Psycho. All right. Let's dive into our opinions here on the movies we watched.
I have one more historical question.
Okay.
What is the definition of a psycho?
Well, a psycho is a psychopath.
Right. And what's the definition of a psychopath?
Okay. I'm going to read you the Merriam-Webster definition, just like it's a bridesmaid speech. Okay. The definition of psychopath, a mentally unstable person, especially a person having an egocentric and antisocial personality marked by a lack of remorse for one's actions, an absence of empathy for others, and often criminal tendencies. So usually psychopaths are defined by that lack of empathy.
Mm.
That because they, like Ted Bundy, for example, right? Because they don't understand. I mean, it's one thing to lack empathy, you know?
Right, James.
And it's another thing to become a serial killer. But it's almost like this perfect, not perfect, but rare set of circumstances that come to be when you have somebody who has this part of their brain, right, that's not functioning in a way that other people's parts of their brain function.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe they're raised in a certain environment or something happens to them, right, and it kind of can create this psychopath or serial killer. But not all psychopaths are criminal, but usually when you have someone who does really horrific crimes like this, there's, you know what I mean? That there's the empathy part is missing.
That makes a lot of sense.
Oh, and one other thing too to call out, just the idea of isolation in Psycho is really important. You know, how Norman Bates is alone in this motel essentially for years and years. It's a thing in the movie that the main highway, the hotel used to sit on a main highway, but then the highway was moved, right? And so now people rarely go there. So it's, and he's still like changing the sheets every week and, you know, so it's like this weird thing of isolation, which is very similar to Ed Gein, who was totally isolated from the world. Just wanted to make sure that similarity was called out.
Some might say it drives you nuts.
We all go a little mad sometimes. All right.
Okay, so, I mean, now is like the portion where we start talking about our thoughts on the films, but we've been kind of doing that throughout.
Yeah.
So the only thing that I want to say, because like, okay, Psycho, great movie. Psycho remake, bad movie. Psycho 2, I loved it. You didn't love it as much.
I don't know how I think I liked the movie, but for me, so this is what happens.
Well, hang on. I don't want to drop spoilers.
No, I'm just going to say the setup of the movie.
Okay, because this, I think this is a movie that's absolutely worth watching.
I agree. And there's some twists and turns.
And I doubt many people have seen it.
Yeah, I didn't know it existed, and it's got Anthony Perkins in it, and it takes place on the same set. Like, it's not a bad movie by any means. The part for me where I'm struggling, which is not a spoiler, is that the premise of the movie is that Norman Bates is released from jail slash the, you know, hospital that he's in,
mm-hmm.
because he is a doctor who believes that he has made all of these strides. And sort of it's interesting because it's like, oh, we've figured out a way past your schizophrenia, right? And so now you can, like, these crimes were not your fault. That's very much how he's painted in the movie, right? As like the victim of his own mental health,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a very like sympathetic and progressive in some ways view of it. But I also think for the level of crimes that he committed,
kill 7 people,
this would never happen, right? You would not be released in this way. And they said because he was guilty by reason of insanity that because now he's quote unquote not insane, that he's being released into the world.
He's done his time to society.
Right. But I think that part to me was jumping the shark a little. But then when you get past that and you accept the fact that this is what's happening in the movie, I agree that the rest of the movie is very good.
Well, I mean, the only more plausible way to get him back on the streets would be is if they like did something really stupid, like forgot to read his like Miranda rights, you know, mm-hmm. and it's just like a court error that gets him out. No matter what you do, putting Norman Bates back on the streets is going to seem like deus ex machina.
Well, they put him, the thing is, though, they put him back into his life.
Well.
And that is what's
surprising.
They're like, here, go live in this house. Like, good luck, friend.
Well, the other thing that should be noted is that we're really nitpicking the bits that like it seems a bit too much like a movie, because the rest of the film seems so grounded in reality.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not at all saying it's a bad movie. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
No, I'm what I'm saying is like these plot holes are only getting the light of day because the rest of the film is so strong.
Yeah, sure. And the Psycho 2 and I think 3 and 4, which we still have to watch, are on Peacock if you have that streaming service, which is free ad supported. So a low barrier of entry if you want to take a look.
There are just so many twists and turns throughout this film. In Psycho 2.
Yeah.
That even when like you and I are like calling out like, oh, wow, this is what's happening. This is the secret agenda of these characters. And then 2 minutes later, like, yeah, we were right, but were we? There's twists upon twists. So I guess it's a Hitchcocky movie but it wasn't directed by Hitchcock.
Yeah, no. Hitchcock wasn't involved in anything with Psycho beyond the original movie.
I don't think he's ever made a sequel to one of his films.
Yeah. I don't believe that he did either.
But a lot of his films have sequels. You just gotta Google.
Okay, so yeah, so that's Psycho 2, which go watch it because again, it doesn't suck.
Or you can really enjoy it like I did.
Yeah. Psycho, the remake from 1998. So we talked about it briefly.
Garbage.
Vince Vaughn, Rita Wilson, William H. Macy.
The only redeeming
Julianne Moore.
No, Julianne Moore was great too.
Julianne Moore is great.
She plays a better sister than the sister does.
Yeah. Star-studded cast. But again, it was literally, besides a few weird choices and things that they added, which were bizarre to me, and didn't make sense psychologically. The film was literally, it looked like a people playing. Like, you know what I mean? It was like, anyway, and because we had just watched Psycho, it was so fresh in our minds. Like, not only is the script identical, but every action of every character was pretty much identical.
You know, you've seen Groundhog's Day, yeah?
Yeah.
So, you know the scene where once Bill Murray is like realizes he's stuck in the loop and he's trying to recreate the first date that makes Annie McDowell fall for him. He's just trying to recreate that like lightning in a bottle, that natural spark. And he's just like going through the motions because he knows it works.
Yep.
But it doesn't work. And like she calls him out on it because it's like doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
That's Psycho remake.
Yeah, absolutely. I said it felt like drama students learning how to be in a film by mimicking. Like, you don't have the core of it. But anyway.
Despite the fact that these are some amazing actors.
Amazing, yeah. It's just interesting. Like, visually, I don't mind it. I know you didn't love it. But it falls flat. Like, it kind of feels like, what's the point of remaking it this way? Like, where it's identical. Like, what's the point?
But then, like, some semi-forgettable characters from the first one, like the sister and the gumshoe, you know?
The PI.
The PI. Yeah.
I don't know that they're forgettable.
Not forgettable, but just like, I don't think when you're talking about Psycho, you're like, do you remember the sister's performance? Wow, that was great.
Yeah.
No, but then you watch Julianne Moore just like dropping fucking fire. As she just like demands answers about her sister, saying the exact same lines.
Well, that's the interesting thing too. I think she makes it work really well. Other actors don't. Like the dialogue seems outdated. Anne Hetch plays Marion Crane, and so the dialogue seems outdated in some sections because it is, mm-hmm. you know. And I think Julianne Moore pulls it off where maybe others don't. But it's weird. I don't know.
Anyways, don't watch it. It's not worth it.
Yeah, but it's also on Peacock, I think, if you wanted to. But
oh, they're all on Peacock. Except the original.
Except the original, which I think is on Hulu. But anyway, I think that wraps up our Psycho episode. So, you know, Psycho, we did the episode on the Stanley Hotel with The Shining. These ones are, I think, like really key staples when you're looking at horror, right? And how the genre has evolved.
Psycho podcast. What'd you say? Bah,
bah, bah. I'm going to get sued now. Well, thank you all so much for listening. If you have other movies, other classics that you think we should take a look at, you know where to find us.
They have to be historically relevant. No, actually, they don't have to be historically relevant because apparently Abby can just start digging and she pulls a whole bunch of history on. I was really surprised. I didn't think that there was going to be a ton on this one.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Here we are, this huge episode that's very historically relevant.
Well, I mean, we could do a whole episode just on Alfred Hitchcock as a person, let alone the films that he makes. You know, they really were so influential at the time and still to this day. So let us know what film, what?
Yeah, so this is as Abby's next deep dive into Muppets 2.
Yeah. So if you have any other films that are not Muppets 2 that you want us to take a deeper look at, let us know.
Well, folks, that wraps it up.
Well, thank you so much for listening. As always, you can find us at The Lunatics Project on Instagram or lunaticsproject.com, where you can access our films, all of our podcast episodes, all of our projects, and our Patreon. Until next time, stay safe, stay spooky.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening. If you'd like some bonus content, consider supporting us on Patreon to access our patron-exclusive podcast, Horror Movie Club.
Also head to lunaticsproject.com to check out our spooky merch and apparel.
You can find us at Lunatics Project on Twitter and TikTok, and The Lunatics Project on Instagram and YouTube, where you'll find our short horror films, cemetery tours, and so much more.
And please rate and review. A little feedback goes a long way to help us grow and get more content out there.
Our cover art is by Pilar Kep, and musical bumpers are by Michaela Papa and Jordan Moser.